when the whenever the court's ready, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, please.
5 minutes, okay.
All right, well, good morning. I'm Lincoln Beauregard, and I represent the plaintiffs and the appellants in this case. I know the court's already familiar with the facts, but it obviously involves a tragic auto accident where the father of this fantastic family lost his life on State Route SR-18. The case itself is a negligent road design case to say that the state of Washington, primarily, is liable for failing to put in a median barrier at the mark cited in the briefing. I think it's barrier 21 to 23, or approximately those at that point. The history of this case is this, in that SR-18 is a known and dangerous roadway that in 1990 through 1992, the state identified that the roadway needed to be repaired.
What evidence is there that the roadway was unreasonably dangerous in 2011 when this accident occurred?
We have not focused on that, Your Honor. We have not focused on the data of that at all, because what we are focusing on is the decision that was made in 1992 that determined at that point in time the roadway was dangerous. And based upon that data that established the roadway was dangerous, the state was on notice that it was a dangerous roadway. And our expert says it should have been remedied at that point. So I'd submit on this record where you're talking about.
Is it fair to say, at least from my review of the record, that the conditions of that section of the roadway where the accident occurred in 2011 are different than they were in 1992?
I'd respectfully say that actually the answer would be no.
No.
That the answer to that would be that the reasonable inference on this evidence would be that they did a roadway repair in 1992. They did not remedy the median barrier discrepancy.
Well, they didn't remedy that, but didn't they submit evidence that there had been other steps that had been taken?
Actually, now, when the court says that, and even to go to Judge Spearman's question, I think that there were some turtles put in, there were some minor revisions that were put in, so the answer would be actually it's not precisely the same as it was in 1992. That's absolutely correct.
So, as I understand it, they moved for summary judgment. They put in that evidence. And in opposition, you relied on your expert who was focused on the 1992 report.
Yes, Your Honor. In relation to the actual breach at issue, our expert says that in 1992, based upon the notice at that moment in time, those engineering judgments were not appropriate. That at that point,
but doesn't the accident have to be that what was the year the accident occurred?
Well, it is 2011, Your Honor.
2011. So in order to have a negligent highway design case, which I assume is what you're saying,
I think to distinguish
yourself from the discretionary immunity case of funding, you're not saying that there was a bad funding decision made. You're saying that the highway was negligently designed.
Correct.
So that when your client, the decedent, went over it in 2011, that negligent design was a cause of the death. But don't you then have to focus on what the condition of the road was in 2011?
I think
not just the fact that it didn't have a barrier.
I think that's absolutely it. And so, again, to kind of return to Judge Spearman's question and fortify the answer to your question, the answer would be absolutely yes. That obviously you do evaluate not just the evidence in isolation in 1992, however, the breach we're saying that occurred in 1992, and the reasonable inference on this evidence.
So what was the breach? What exactly was it?
The breach was the failure to install the median barrier.
Okay, and that's based on your expert?
That's based on
And the 1992 expert. Report.
And the 1992 report, yes, Your Honors. So the better.
But I'm sorry, I just don't get that, because, I mean, in other words, the duty is to design the highway in a way that makes it reasonably safe for ordinary travel.
Okay,
so, but the accident occurs at a certain point in time. I mean, and if the conditions of the highway have changed, I just don't see how you can go back to 1992. I mean, why not go back to 1962, you know, when the decision was made perhaps to make this a two-lane highway rather than a four-lane highway or something like that?
Sure.
I mean, I don't see how you can get around your problem of showing breach of duty by looking at what happened in 1992 in isolation from what happened, from what actually was on the ground in 2011.
Certainly, and I think the analysis would go like this. We cited the WPI that talks about the need to remedy a dangerous condition. The dangerous condition in 1992 was the high level of fatality crossovers in that time frame. That particular problem was never remedied, and inherent in our expert's opinion, I can't remember how specifically he says it, but inherent in his opinion, is that hazard still existed as of 2011. So our case is...
Doesn't that kind of analysis, though, isn't that more appropriate to cases where there's a hazard that wasn't created by the state that they've gotten notice of, and then the breach occurs when they don't repair because they've had notice? Here we're talking about a negligent highway design case. So
I would say that...
Isn't the duty a little bit different?
Do you want to go into your 5 minutes?
I would love to answer the judge's question.
Okay.
So if I could take another minute. I think the answer to the court's question is it more normally... I think it's more commonly seen in the context of a Department of Corrections case or some other notice case where there's an indication of a harm and it needs to be remedied. And in a Department of Transportation case, it is more commonly contextualized in the situation where you're saying there's a negligent road design and it exists contemporaneously. That does not mean that this particular cause of action, which is recognized by McCluskey and the other case law, is not appropriate. The pattern jury instruction that we cited, and the state says that, oh, we're citing the wrong jury instruction for our cause of action, it specifically says when the state's on notice of an inherently dangerous condition, you have to fix it.
Okay, so you weren't going to give the WPI instruction that talks about they have a duty to make the road safe for ordinary travel.
We would give that one as well. However, we think the one that we've cited, and I can't remember if it's in the briefing, is the one about the prior notice of dangerous incidents. We think that was an overlay to this case, more specifically appropriate, because the question is, did they know that roadway was dangerous in 1992, and they never fixed it? And that's our case. Thank you.
All right, thank you. You have 4 minutes.
Good morning again. May it please the court, my name is Steve Puz. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the Department of Transportation in this case. Your honors have actually hit the essence of our case. First, Judge Spearman, you're absolutely right. The test in this case is whether or not the highway was reasonably safe for ordinary travel on the date of the collision, which was April 23rd, 2011. That's the sole question before you. And the whoopee that they're citing simply is inapplicable here. As you pointed out, it pertains to things that defects that arise in the road that were not caused by the transportation agency itself. For example, sudden formation of ice, like this court dealt with in the Laguna case, or blackberry bushes that grew up on land adjacent.
Well, we've heard the argument, which is the 1992 report and their expert relying on that 1992 report says this is a hazardous, it was a hazardous highway. It still is, even in 2011, a hazardous highway because you didn't put in the median. What's your response to that?
Well, again, I think the starting point is this, that the only date that's relevant to this case is April 23rd, 2011.
Well, but there's no median, and you have a report that says that there should be a median, or the WSDOT should consider putting in a median. So what evidence do we have in the record about the condition of the highway in 2011 and why it was or wasn't hazardous?
Two things. One, as this court pointed out in its questions to counsel, the character, performance, and safety of the highway was different in 2011 than
it
was in 1992.
Not necessarily in the way that plaintiff's talking about. They say, well, in 1992, you knew you should have put a barrier there. And here we are in 2011, you still haven't put a barrier there. And so in that sense, if a danger was created by the lack of a barrier, then that danger still exists. I mean, I think that's there.
Respectfully, a barrier is a fix. A barrier is a fix that occurs once you determine that a highway is not reasonably safe for ordinary travel. And that begs the question in this case as to whether they presented any evidence at all that the highway was not reasonably safe for ordinary travel on April 23rd, 2011. And I think you just heard counsel tell you that they produced absolutely no evidence on that fact.
Well, they're arguing there's the inference from the 1992 report and their expert. But what in opposition, what did you present to show that it was reasonably safe for ordinary travel?
Thank you. And what we did produce is evidence that the character and the performance and the safety of the highway was different in 2011 than it was in 1992, and this is demonstrated in a number
of the fatalities, fatality accidents?
Well, two, in a number of different ways. One, the character of the highway itself had changed. I mean, there had been changes to not only SR-18, dramatic changes to SR-18 after 1992, but there were changes to this particular stretch of highway, including the installation of rumble strips. The undisputed evidence is that the accident history, the number of accidents that occurred in this section had decreased throughout the 10-year period leading up to this accident. And in 2007, when those rumble strips were put into place, there is also a corresponding decrease in the accident rate, to the point where the accident history of this road was comparable to similar roadways found throughout the state of Washington. There was nothing unusual, much less dangerous, about this particular stretch of highway. All of that evidence is undisputed. I'll just point out, what we're talking about here is a straight stretch of highway where there's clear visibility in both directions. It's undisputed that the lanes, the asphalt, the striping, every aspect about this roadway itself fell within accepted design standards, and again, was comparable to highways that are found throughout Washington and throughout the nation. And the undisputed evidence shows that, with the changes that were made to SR-18 itself, as well as the specific changes that were made to this stretch of highway, there was a reduction in accidents. It was safer. It performed better. So
your argument is you put in that evidence and there was no contradiction to that evidence.
There wasn't any contradiction to that evidence. First of all, our point is twofold. One, putting in evidence about what the condition of the road was in 1992 without showing that same condition or problem existed in 2011 doesn't make a prima facie case. They failed to make a prima facie case on their own, but the judge didn't have to rely on that below. The judge also had the undisputed evidence that the state did produce showing that the highway itself was reasonably safe for ordinary travel.
Now,
let me ask you a question about a different topic. I am concerned about this discretionary immunity argument. In your brief, you agree that discretionary immunity doesn't apply when there's an operational decision.
Oh.
And also when it's the negligent design of, you say, a funded roadway safety improvement. But where I am concerned about your argument is you say when the decision involves whether a roadway safety improvement should be funded and or constructed, discretionary immunity applies. And I take it that you're trying to convince us that So whenever there is a negligent highway design case that says we should have, it would have made the road safe for ordinary travel if a barrier had been constructed, that because that involves a funding decision, that it's discretionary.
That's actually not our position. There's two different questions.
But I mean, if this is strictly a highway design case, then you shouldn't be arguing discretionary immunity. I'm concerned about the possibility of you taking a case like Avellaneda. And taking it to trial courts and saying, well, somebody had to make a decision here about whether to put in the median barrier, and we didn't have enough money, so discretionary immunity applies.
I respect that concern. That is not what the state is doing here. It's the plaintiff in this case brought a motion for partial summary judgment on the discretionary immunity defense, claiming that the decisions that in 1992 were made on the funding are not entitled to discretionary immunity. The state responded, I think appropriately so, pointing out exactly why under Avellaneda the funding decisions there are entitled to discretionary immunity. But that's a separate topic from whether or not the roadway itself is reasonably safe for ordinary travel. Now, you know, they focused on
not to blend together.
I respectfully don't agree. I think they have in some of the briefing that's before the court here, but generally these issues do not blend together. The difficulty is that when the plaintiffs started talking about 1992 and the design decisions, they blended them together. And what we did is we separated them out. What we said.
So what was your affirmative? I mean, you asserted affirmative defense of discretionary immunity. What was your grounds for making that assertion?
Because in the complaint themselves, they were raising questions about the 1992 decisions. In the course of the litigation, they have been raising questions about the 1992 decisions on funding for this 1992 design report. And to the extent, and so we were asserted an affirmative defense that pertained to that. But throughout this case, what we've said is, look, we don't think they made a prima facie case showing that the highway was unsafe in 1992. But even if they did, they can't make the leap for 19 years later and an established proximate cause. And it's based entirely on speculation. You've just heard counsel admit it, and they admitted it with the witnesses.
Well, if there is a problem with their argument, it would be that they aren't talking about what the condition of the road was in 2011, but that does not mean that every time somebody comes in with a highway design case and says, you know, it would have been, it was negligent not to fund this barrier, that you get to say, oh, we don't even get to go to the questions of duty and proximate cause, Your Honor, because this was a funding decision, and we're entitled to discretionary immunity with respect to the decisions to the highway improvements that we fund or do not fund.
I promise you that's not the argument that
okay.
we're making
All
here.
All right. Well, I'm happy to hear that.
The argument that we're making here is that they didn't make a negligence case, and they didn't preserve that issue on appeal. And that's where I intended to spend all of my time.
Preserve that issue? Being the negligence issue?
That's right. One, because they didn't assign error to it, and they didn't provide any argument to it on their brief. And under all of the cases cited, they've abandoned that issue, if I may just conclude. This was a tragic case. It was a tragic case caused by two reckless, criminally reckless, road rage combatants who did the unbelievably stupid thing of trying to pass one another by speeding up and driving on the shoulder of the highway. This is an accident caused by two bad drivers. It had nothing to do with the highway. This highway was reasonably safe for ordinary travel on April 23rd, 2011, and all of the evidence in the record before you establishes that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Beauregard, I gave you another minute.
Thank you. I want to give a better answer in relation to the question about the applicable WPI. We cited it in the brief, but I'm citing it now again. It's WPI 140.02, of course, fortified by the case law. What that particular WPI says is that a state and municipality, what have you, must fix a condition that is not created necessarily by the state and make it safe if they have notice of it. Here, what they had notice of was a condition that generally was not created by the state. It was people crossing over the center line. It was a dangerous roadway in that respect with an extremely high proportion of fatalities. So in that regard, that particular WPI applies because they were on notice that people like her and Willing were speeding down the road. It wasn't a road rage incident, but going too fast, creating a dangerous condition themselves that the state had an obligation to fix because they were on notice of it. That's why we think that WPI applies. I do agree with the judge that normally you see that particular notice remedy situation in different types of cases. I've done them all. If you even analyze this case under the common negligence standard, I think that you still get to the point where my clients are entitled to a trial on the issue. I'm going to make the mistake of arguing against myself for a minute to try and synthesize the arguments because I think that the answer to the question that I'm going to pose to myself and offer to this court is in our favor. The court's concerned itself with the fact that we are criticizing a 1992 decision for an accident that happened in 2011. It's not a common fact pattern. It doesn't come up all the time. Normally, you'll see a fact pattern with a more condensed situation. I do them all the time. That does not change the fact that the particular premises of law apply, and I think that the state's best analysis is probably to look more to the proximate cause and the foreseeability elements that we're not really spiritedly focused upon in the briefing or at the trial court. And in the proximate cause and the foreseeability analysis, the question would be, can a breach in 1992 result in the state being liable for an accident in 2011? And that question would be a question of proximate cause of law and policy, and it would be a question of proximate cause on a but-for, and it would be a question of proximate cause on foreseeability. On the issue of law and policy, that's for you to hear decide today based on the evidence of the case, in large part. I think the answer should be, as a matter of law and policy, when the state knows that people are getting killed on a roadway, they try and fix it, but they don't fix it right. That blends into not just proximate cause, but also issues of foreseeability. It was no less foreseeable that somebody would cross the roadway in 2011 than it was in 1992, or at least it's a question of fact for a jury. A couple of rumble strips that was installed, I don't remember exactly what our expert says, but embodied in his opinions are that the breach in 1992 caused what happened in 2011, and rumble strips weren't enough. That's the inference from my expert's testimony. I don't think that he said specifically the rumble strips were good enough or not. So I submit to you.
Didn't he say that he was limiting his analysis to 1992 and was not looking at the condition of the highway in 2011?
For the purpose of the breach, that's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And the reason why we did that as a matter of truth and a matter of, quite frankly, litigation strategy as well, but with full integrity to the facts of the case, or this, is that with a negligent road design case, you cannot and should not be able to come in and argue that the state should have just arbitrarily improved the roadway at some point in time, unless they were actually in the process of doing it already, and there was actually already a funding in place. Because if you make that argument in any context, if I was to have my expert come in and say, I think in 2009 you should have put in some medium barriers, then quite understandably the question becomes, well, you can't say that they just have to put in medium barriers because there was no allocation funds. There was no process to undertaken at that moment in time. So that what you're doing in a backwards sense is saying that the legislature should have said, I'm going to allocate more money spontaneously because that's a dangerous roadway. And that does go into an analysis of discretionary immunity, and we purposefully avoided that because of the case law that is very stringent on that point. So in the relation to framing this case, we were very careful to say we are only going to analyze the history of allocated funds for when they did try and make the roadway safe, and only going to have our expert observe and criticize the actual actions that were undertaken.
Well, if this accident had happened the day after the report came out, would the state be liable?
No, they wouldn't.
About a week after?
They would not.
2 years?
After 2 years, I believe they actually had implemented the safety design remedies that they intended. So at that point, yes. But absolutely not. I would agree with the state. It would be a discretionary immunity against my clients if this accident happened the day after the report and the moment which this was funded. Because realistically, that would be an Avellaneda case or a Jensen case where the people were trying to criticize the speed with which the government moved in funding a project, whereas here we're only criticizing discrete decisions that led to my client's demise. Thank you for your attention. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. The next case.